Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Oh, hello. It's Wednesday, and it's time to welcome you to Waypoints, where the Waypoint staff and friends take a break to nerd out and deep dive on the culture, art, and entertainment that's been inspiring and provoking us lately. Gathered around the table this Wednesday, we've got Patrick Klepek.
Hello.
Danielle Riendo.
Hi.
And Austin Walker.
Hey, how's it going?
Well, I don't know. How's anything going these days,
Rob?
Austin?
Do you want to talk about climate change? I feel like you got thoughts.
Oh, yeah, God. You want to talk?
I do.
The apocalypse.
I talked a lot at my therapist's office the other day, and you know things are dark when like you're pretty sure your therapist is like on the phone with their therapist like the minute you wrap up. Anyway. Yeah, it has been. It's been kind of a dark week. The kind of week that can lead one to a bit or more than a bit of despair. And perhaps knowing that, perhaps anticipating it, I recently got back into one of my favorite novel series, the Night Soldier series by Alan First. And I don't know if like y'all are familiar with this. It's actually a surprisingly long running series, but it's like one of those series that has been around for a while, but only really started to catch on, I would say, in the last like 10, 15 years. And they are all like espionage suspense novels set in interwar Europe, particularly like the last few years before the outbreak of World War II. Huh. And they are, I have complicated feelings about these because like a lot of authors who do genre work for a long time, there's a tendency to become a little bit formulaic. It's very tough, I think, for working writers to avoid the pull of the familiar. Like, people have their own tics, their stylistic habits and patterns, and you read enough of someone's series, you start to see those again and again, and it can cause them to pale a little bit. I think at times, First series does fall into that trap, and that's why I took a little break from them, but I got back into it this past weekend by reading a book called Dark Voyage. And it was useful because it was exactly one of those types of books I was describing, right? It's a bit formulaic, like they're familiar beats in the story, but damn, they're good beats. Like, right. I really enjoyed getting back into it, and I think what was really nice about reading it is the cool thing that these novels do is they're espionage thrillers about a war we know a lot of the arc of. We know a lot of what's going to happen. And so it's a spy series about trying to figure out intention and the truth of what's behind different actions and what's going to happen in the future. And as the reader, you always roughly know what's going to happen. And that also means that a lot of these characters are kind of screwed. And we know that too. And for some reason, I think that makes me like the series a little bit more, if that makes sense.
More than you would, than you think you would in a kind of abstract way, or more than other spy fiction?
I think perhaps a little bit more than other spy fiction. Because, ooh. Well, let me put it this way. I don't think First compares particularly well to Le Carre. I mean, Le Carre at his best.
Do you
want to
like set up what that means for people who don't know what these names mean? Or like, I realize now that like I'm a neophyte in spy fiction, right? Like, I've read a little Le Carre. This is the first time I'm reading the person whose name I've already forgotten.
First.
There's an S before that. First. And so I know Le Carre's reputation, and I know how people talk about Le Carre, but a lot of people probably don't, and I certainly don't have the full context of like what is the genre? What is the state of the genre in 2018?
2018. I'm probably not up enough on the current stuff to give you a great answer to that, but I would say the spy novel genre tends to fall into different, let's call them buckets, right? Like there are your more thriller type writers. At times, Tom Clancy is basically writing those. Like his best work in that front is The Cardinal of the Kremlin, which is his stab at a serious spy novel. But it's still a Tom Clancy novel. In the end, you know, the good guys win. There are heroes in the story. There are people portrayed very sympathetically. And I think at the other end of the spectrum, you've got John Le Carre, who, you know, most recognizable from Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. And Le Carre is, well, A, he's writing something that I think a lot of people would term basically like literature. His best works, I think, are taken seriously by literary critics in a way Tom Clancy never is or would be, right?
Right.
And the other aspect of that is Le Carre is writing something that's very informed by the history and the things associated with British espionage in World War II and after. So it's very Oxbridge inflected, because the thing to remember about the British spy programs is that they tended to be packed with people, graduates of elite universities, like probably even more elitist than like the early days of the CIA, for instance. And they were also sort of racked by scandals throughout the 60s, 70s, and into the 80s, where they kept basically uncovering like massive conspiracies of double agents.
Right. And the KGB was all the way up in the British spy system.
Right. And it was basically like a huge disaster for the prestige of the British Secret Service, but also really raised questions about sort of the blind spots and assumptions that went into selecting agents like that. But where all that comes out in Le Carre's fiction is sort of a beautiful despair. I think a friend of mine put it really well when he got me into Le Carre. He argued that the central tenet of Le Carre's books, particularly the novel starring George Smiley, are fundamentally about the death of the West as an idea that was worth like holding on to, right? Like like the argument being made is that the Cold War and the paranoia and the moral cost of steering two major Western empires through World War II and after basically demolishes a lot of the ideals that informed and sculpted a lot of the people attracted to spycraft in Britain. And that's sort of the backdrop for Le Carre's books. There's a very like heavy thesis being made. First isn't quite doing that. First wants to like put you there. Like he wants you to experience what it may have been like to be someone on the ground watching.
It's like something phenomenological. Like, you know, the great phenomenological philosophers would describe for you the sound of the ringing of the bell. And in my experience of reading First so far, it's like, boy, I have a really good idea of what those fascists feel like to be around, and like what the boots feel like on my back, and what the uniforms look like, and what the smell of this cafe is like, and what the, you know, what the expression is on the face of the woman who knows that she's about to betray me or whatever, right? Like that stuff is not there. There is something just like, it's almost, I want to say like, not exploitation fiction about it, like exploitation film about it, but it is this sort of like enhanced senses. It's a sensual sort of spy fiction from what I'm reading, right? It's very much interested in, and I don't mean sensual in the James Bond fucky sense. I mean,
it definitely gets a little fucky as the series.
Okay, I've not gotten
on
to the fuckiness quite yet. So I'm looking forward to it. But for now, it's like very much like the place and time is just so striking. And a lot to what you said before, which is like, yeah, I know where this goes. You know, I know what happens in this part of the world just a few years later.
Yeah, I think that vividness is probably what the series accomplishes at its best, because what's most relatable in this is this feeling of the alienation from reality you experience as all the shit is happening in front of you, which I think is something a lot of us have struggled with ourselves in the last year or two. But there's this great moment, I think, in the book you're reading, Austin, Night Soldiers. It's either in Night Soldiers or Dark Star, which is the second. But there is a lengthy sequence on that takes place during Kristallnacht. Ooh. And there is this aside where the spy, the Soviet spy, is sort of fleeing from these roving bands of fascists, you know, laying waste to Jewish stores and neighborhoods. And he flees from them, and he eventually finds sanctuary with this, like, you know, Berlin cop, basically. Right. And he's just an old, like, he's just an old beat cop, basically. And he has this brief exchange with this officer, but what makes the moment really great is he describes the moment where you can see the look on this guy's face as he realizes, like, his entire life built around the idea of, like, maintaining order and putting a stop to shit like this and, like, you know, sending hooligans packing and all that stuff. All that's literally going up in smoke before his eyes. And he's been given official orders, like, don't get in these guys' way. Like, they're doing the Fuhrer's well. And realizing that, like, that's who I serve now. That's my reality. And the things that gave me my identity, I'm now completely, I still have my job, I still have my place, but, like, I'm completely unmoored from my identity and the things I, like, believed about the world. And that's kind of first at his best. And that's kind of what keeps me coming back, are those little grace notes about ordinary people suddenly comprehending that, like, oh, we're not just going to get out of this.
Right, we're in it.
Yeah.
This is a thing, I think that's, we joke about the global warming thing up top. We talk often about fascism and proto-fascism in the world in 2018. We probably do not have time to get into the elections in Brazil over the past couple of weeks right now. But, like, we are in it in a way that is I think a lot about a meeting I had right after the Trump election 2 years ago, in which all the EIC's advice we always had a Friday meeting at the time every week. And we used to get together in the Munchies kitchen advice and aww, have cocktails or have, like, a drink and, like, talk about what we're proud of from all of our teams that week and talk about what initiatives we had going on. We still have meetings like that. They're just a little different now. But the one immediately after the election was, you know, 2 or 3 days after, and was, I guess 3 days after, and was incredibly down at first. You know, obviously we were all people who expected the other outcome, or at least hoped for the other outcome in that election, and who were scrambling to figure out how do we do our jobs in a world where Donald Trump is the president, where a campaign like that one is what won. What does this say about our nation? Does this mean that we should be trying to get out of the current bubbles of coverage that we're in? Should we be paying more attention to the flyover states, quote unquote? Should there be more debates? Should we debate the issues more? Or should we double down and make sure we're not falling into issues of false equivalency? And all those questions were in our head. But I remember leaving that meeting at a certain point and coming out, like, really energized and like, yeah, we're gonna tackle this thing. And it has been 2 years since that. And any what I think of in that meeting was this, what I recognize now as a sort of naivete that we thought we were going to do a thing and not, like, save the day. There was not a messianic complex, but there was a feeling of, like, okay, well, we're going to come into work on Monday and then we're going to do the thing that we need to do. And the recognition 2 years on is like, oh, no. Like, every aspect of life is now constantly colored in this way because we are in it. And so it is not about figuring out an action so much as figuring out a posture and adapting everything we do going forward. I'm like barely a quarter of the way through Night Soldiers, but I do sense a lot of that here. I do sense a lot of the, like, oh, the way I used to move through my town is not the same anymore. The way I used to relate to the, like, shitty rich family in this town, like, it doesn't fly anymore. And it's not just, like, this was one instance where someone overreacted. It's, like, the basic formula has shifted. And so I used to count for two, and now I count for one. What do I do now? How do I adjust to that? So that's definitely speaking to me so far in Night Soldiers.
Yeah, like, I think one of the other things that I've been really getting some relief from in these books is that the cool trick of perspective that they play is basically for the characters you're reading about, everything looks like it's utterly hopeless. Like, and some of the books end on basically like this note of, and by the way, this may have all been for nothing. Like, there's a book basically where it's about this French intelligence officer working in Poland. He sort of catches wind of some things the Germans are studying with regard to tanks and how they can, like, and their ability to traverse difficult terrain. And sort of the culmination of it is, it has this great passage, he goes through Germany. And again, one of those little beats that first is so good at capturing is the terror of going through Germany in, like, 1938. And he was like, this country of, you know, millions and millions of people, how do all of them, like, have this fanatical, like, idea of what it is to be German? Like, Poland's a new country, and they're still sorting out, like, what the hell does it mean to be a Pole? And here he's going through this country where, like, everyone is super hyped about being a German. And just the utter, like, terror of uniformity that he sees there. But the novel culminates in him literally seeing the Germans practicing for the invasion of France, like, coming through the Ardennes Forest. And he's like, we got it. We have a good idea of what their military plans are going to be when they attack France. We've got the plan. We're going to give it to French intelligence. And French intelligence's reaction is basically like, well, that doesn't seem very likely. Like, that's like really hard.
Death Star plans, and they're like, yeah, no one would build a death. They're calling it the Death Star. Really,
they're going to get an entire tank army through a forest? No, no. Mm. And the end of the book is like, yeah, this the entire action they've been doing is like basically for naught. But I think the thing that I do like about it is that it is a reminder that you can never see the end of this shit when you're in it. Like, all these characters, like, the triumph of Nazi Germany and fascism starts to seem increasingly inevitable. You know, the communists are knocked off one by one and seem increasingly unable to mount an effective response. And then the non-aggression pact happens. Yeah. And so Stalin has basically given up the fight and doesn't give a shit. Yeah. And so all these characters are convinced, like, they're kind of witnessing the end of history in a terrible way. And what you know as the reader is, like, this inexorability of fascism that it desperately wants you to believe in, the inevitability of its desired outcomes, can go away really fucking fast, and can change really fast. Especially because the other part of these books is they're arrogant fucking people.
Right. I think the last thing I'll say here is that feeling of it feeling. I mean, I think we'll wrap back around to this when we get to my waypoint in a bit. But like that feeling of inevitability of closed off alternatives of the feeling that like, oh, this is it. Like this is where this is all going is so stifling and so it's so depressing, and I don't just mean that in an emotional sense. I mean that in terms of, like, it removes the ability to act. It means, I mean that in, like, a very, like, all that energy gets deflated and you just can't do shit. And it is one of those things where, like, intellectually, that is where I align with so many things. When I run the numbers, right, when I look at everything, when I think about how I believe the world is working and how the various forces that are in power function, I am like fairly, I guess philosophically, I would say nihilistic not pessimistic, which is to say, I don't think that there's, which is to say, like, I think we can still find our own meaning in this. I think we can still find our own subjective value in it. But, like, I don't know that there's a coming out of it in a good way. But in my heart, I know that there is not, there's no value in preaching that belief. Because when I look at these, like, spies, they would continue to do the work they did. And, you know, eventually maybe someone would take their shit seriously, right? Maybe it wouldn't be the plans for the Blitzkrieg, but it would be the U-boat, strategies there or plans, right? It would be plans about weapon development. There are wins in here, and it's not, you know, not to like completely mix metaphors here, but like you got to swing when you're at the plate, right? And if you don't swing, you're going to get struck out. And that is an inevitability, even if when I look at the batter, when I look at the pitcher, when I look at everything that's happening, and it's like, this is a little league player going up against like a Hall of Famer, he's going to get struck out no matter what, you know, maybe there's a bunt in there. Maybe there's a lucky hit and everything falls apart and there is a chance for change. And so, yeah, it has actually been a little bit of a relief to dig into something. And also there's just a degree of detail in these books that is like a fun escape. There is something, it's interesting to read a book in which that opens with someone being beat by a fascist, beat to death by a fascist, and still feeling like, I'm escaping into this novel. But here we are in 2018 where that is a possibility.
Yeah. Speaking of there being no escape and not seeing a way for the little leaguer to take on the Hall of Famer at the mound. Patrick, let's talk a little bit about your waypoint this week, which is an article about Mark Zuckerberg sort of trying to reckon with the thing he's built.
It's a piece by Evan Osnos, who's one of the most talented writers over at The New Yorker. He does a lot of really great lengthy profiles and things like that. And he has a piece that went up a couple weeks back called Can Mark Zuckerberg Fix Facebook Before It Breaks Democracy? Which poses a big question and at first suggests that it's just going to be an editorial riffing on Facebook and social media. But actually, it's a really lengthy profile of Mark Zuckerberg that sort of tries to, I think, answer like a pretty fundamental question that people didn't think that much about when Facebook was just seen as a fun tool to share photos and like have conversations, or it was just purely a communications tool that allowed you to talk to people in a way that felt more casual than text messages and phone calls, which is like, oh, actually, you know, Facebook is its own nation state at this point. And who is the person running this thing? They are not, not elected. You can't kick them out. And yet they have an enormous amount of influence. Like, who actually is this person? And it's, you know, the piece opens with the great irony that Mark Zuckerberg is an incredibly private person, and yet he has created a service that is built upon a philosophy that people should share more often and that they may be uncomfortable with it, but they'll get used to it. And it's really long. It's like, you know, it's like a 30-40 minute read. It's a really interesting deep dive into both the history of Facebook, the psychology of Facebook, and trying to get at like who is Mark Zuckerberg. I mean, I'm fairly sure we're probably all on the same page based on our pre-show conversation. That I came away like upset, disturbed, angry, and thinking that Mark Zuckerberg is not the person that should be running that company anymore. Like, this is someone who he has dangerous ideas for how society should be run and the way that his company should use the power it has built. I came away very disturbed about like the picture it paints about a person who has tremendous power and doesn't seem to do a whole lot of self-reflection over what he should be doing with it or not doing with it.
Yeah, it's a really, it's a strange thing, because I also came away, like, with every passage, I became more and more put off by him. And the weird thing is, like, he becomes, it's a strange thing. First, it feels like he is trying very hard to come across as aggressively normal. Yeah. The jokes about, like, Mark Zuckerberg being an alien wearing a person's skin and hoping nobody catches on to it, like, even in this profile, he still fundamentally comes across as somebody who's just trying really hard to be bland and anodyne and yet also a little bit warm and familiar in a way that feels unpracticed, but not natural is the strange thing. But that's just the way these things feel. The thing that keeps putting me off as I read it is that this seems like somebody who is perpetually naive, perpetually hasn't thought through the thing, or thinks that, you know, if he just gets the right data, he will be able to be the one to implement the fix. At right. every turn, he just seems like somebody who, on a very deep level, remains an arrogant person who doesn't know what he doesn't know and is forever playing catch up on a reality he's been very irresponsible with.
It is like, not only does he think he has the data to make the calls, he often doesn't think he has the data. He doesn't even think, do I need data to make calls? He'll make a call on a gut or on the request of his partner. Or
contrarian just to be contrarian, right? Yeah. He comes from a Silicon Valley philosophy of people are going to tell you what you're doing is the wrong thing. Prove them wrong. And there's a certain, you understand the attraction to that philosophy that, like, new ideas are going to be seen as something that may not be the correct path, but he's taken that to such an irresponsible length that it no longer, applies anymore. And in fact, to continue to adhere to that philosophy, what is it? The philosophy that they were built on was like move fast and break things.
Yeah.
You get what the attraction is there, but it's like, hey, like people are like a genocide is being committed using Facebook as a primary tool to dehumanize people. And you're just now getting around to like hiring people that speak that language. What the fuck?
There's a two or three paragraph spread towards the middle of it where they talk about a few initiatives that Facebook has had. I mean, they talk about a lot. There's a lot of like fantastic information here about what things got prioritization in terms of resourcing, like the growth team, unsurprisingly, versus the teams about making sure that they weren't like completely harming people. But there's this moment where his partner Chan. Patricia Chan, is that her first name?
I believe so, yeah.
Priscilla Chan, thank you. Says like, oh, hey, it's like in 2012, and is like, hey, the world really needs more organ donors. And so Zuckerberg was like, I know what we should do is we should just do like a little thing that says like, if you're an organ donor, you can mark it, and that will trigger a notification to your friends. And then maybe that'll be like, you know, peer pressure and people will sign up to be organ donors. And it jumped like 20-fold, not 20%, 20-fold, 20 times.
There was the other one. There's this passage.
It's like
Facebook,
right
also,
that.
Facebook also discovered its power to affect people's political behavior. Researchers found that during the 2010 midterm elections, Facebook was able to prod users to vote simply by feeding them pictures of friends who'd already voted and by giving them the option to click on an I voted button. I like distinctly remember like that feature. The technique boosted turnout by 340,000 people, more than four times the number of votes separating Trump and Clinton in key states in the 2016 race. It became a running joke among employees that Facebook could tilt an election just by choosing where to deploy its I voted button. And the key word there is like joke, right? Like the way that I mean, obviously working on anything, you have to have some sort of emotional distance from it, like no matter how powerful it is, but the notion that it became like those sorts of things were treated as a joke, like underscores the lack of responsibility that is illustrated like writ large in this piece, top down from Zuckerberg below, how Facebook is run as an organization and as a philosophy and ultimately as an ideology.
There is a passage in here, and of course there's a million great passages, but this was something that really struck out to me, especially as somebody, you know, fan of Halt and Catch Fire, and also somebody who just is interested in how, obviously, any technology is just an extension of the person who made it, or the people who made it, right? And everything about this has to do with the ubiquity of this as a platform, of the fact that, you know, 2.2 billion people, the amount that... Like, this is a significant chunk of humanity.
It's as much as, like, Christianity, right?
Yeah,
like, it's the analogy that was used, yeah. Yeah.
Really, really incredible. And then there's this passage that just talks about kind of early days at Facebook, but, like, what it all kind of came from. And it says, you know, Zuckerberg carried two sets of business cards. One said, I'm CEO, bitch. Visitors encountered a graffiti mural of a scantily clad woman riding a Rottweiler. In Adam Fisher's Valley of Genius in Oral History of Silicon Valley, an early employee named Ezra Callahan muses. How much was the direction of the internet influenced by the perspective of 19, 20, 21-year-old yes. well-off white yes. boys?
That quote,
that's a question
like,
sociologists will be studying forever.
That was like yeah. such a red flag, like when it, which is, it's one of those like completely obvious takeaways, but then when someone actually says it, you just go, holy shit.
Yep.
Other good quote is by Chamath Palihapitiya, who is the former VP of user growth, who in 2011, I think, said, quote here, of his children, he added, they're not allowed to use this shit.
Yeah.
After saying the short-term dopamine-driven feedback loops that we've created are destroying how society works. No civil discourse, no cooperation, misinformation, mistruth. So this is not my waypoint this week, but a friend and I have been watching a series of British shows that are called Hidden Killers of the Blank Home. And blank is filled in with like Edwardian or Victorian, right? And it's a series that's about the ways in which people were being killed in these early
modern... How many episodes can you get out of that premise?
I think it's like 5 or 6. Okay. I've seen like 4. I've seen Edwardian. I've seen Victorian. They do 2 different Victorian ones. And, you know, it's a lot of things that we now think like, yeah, of course, you can't put arsenic in your fucking wallpaper. It's arsenic. I don't care how good the green looks, you idiot. It's arsenic. Don't do it. So stuff like that. It's stuff like people not knowing how electricity works or how like gas pipes work or the way toilets were first invented. It's all these like, it's a lot of these like, wow, this technology is incredible. And also it's fucking killing us. Mm-hmm. And it's so hard for me not to look at this story and look at things like the voter turnout thing. The idea that like, oh yeah, we're just going to toss a button on here that's going to increase voter turnout by hundreds of thousands of people and think about deploying that sort of stuff in such a unilateral way with again and again, there are these examples where it's like Zuckerberg decided to do this or one other person or other division decided to do that without any sorts of like care, without a lot of research into what the effects might be, or with the sort of research into the effects that is itself maybe unethical because it's research done without any actual real, informed consent. It's just people being like, I'll use Facebook, and that means they can do whatever they want.
Yeah, I wanted this cosmology thing, you know, like right. I wanted to read about my fate, and then all of a sudden you've turned over like your photo data because...
Yeah. It's so hard not to imagine us looking back at this moment in 100 years with the hidden killers of the Trumpinian, you know, home or whatever the fuck it is, and being like, yeah, those motherfuckers were stupid. They made like Facebook and just letting these people completely tinker with the basic structure of their democracy and their civil society.
I think one of the other reasons that maybe you're primed to have this guy come across poorly to you in this article is that the title sets up this expectation that he is wrestling with this thing he's built. Right. How do we fix Facebook before it fucks up democracy, basically? How do we make this thing we built not terrible? But as you read it, that's not actually what they're wrestling with, is the thing. It's like like the Death Star metaphor is apt. It's like the Death Star designer. Not the one in Rogue One, but like just your hypothetical Death Star designer. basically saying, well, like, obviously we don't want to take the Death Star apart. We don't want to not have a Death Star. But how do we make the Death Star less of a planet killer?
Right.
And you can't do those two things. Like, its very existence is, like, it exists to be this enormous powerhouse. It exists to be bent toward bad ends. That's where its power is and its influence it can project. It exists to do that. This entire piece is about people trying to find a way to like make the thing that is almost inherently bad because of its size be not bad, but the same size, but also more importantly, be the same size. Don't get broken up. Be just good enough not to get like antitrusted.
Yeah, the Bill Gates through line in this is really fascinating, and how if there is a flaw in the piece, it doesn't more fully go into the Microsoft breakup of the 90s, they kind of just pass over that as though like, ah, just be nice to Washington, and like as though there was no legitimate reason to look into Microsoft's monopoly.
They actually get into that specific thing on the Facebook side where Zuckerberg is like, well, we don't have a monopoly. The fact that we're big and we do a bunch of different things.
We're competing with Netflix for people's time. That's competition.
Motherfucker, that is literally a monopoly. The idea that you are the single place, the single point of service for a number of connected industries is literally what a monopoly is. Like, that is not a, no one is playing with words. There's no hyperbole there. The thing that Mark Zuckerberg in this piece describes Facebook as is like a textbook definition of a monopoly. And the thing that actually bothers me more is, to go back to your point, Rob, of like, oh, is this guy actually, is this place even really thinking about the problem of what Facebook means for democracy, or what Facebook means for, again, for civil society or discourse or any of that other stuff? Not only are they not thinking about it in a way that is kind of unrestrained from a fear of breaking up or destroying their own thing, but they're also, in the moments where he talks about in this piece society or history or government, it's wrong. There's this moment where he's talking about Augustus.
Is this the Caesar moment?
Yeah, it's the Caesar moment.
Oh God, that,
Jesus, take the wheel.
I'll let you take the time. Like, this is one of my favorite moments in the way that a writer throws unbelievable shade at the figure they're profiling. Yeah. Without necessarily, like, totally hitting them with the hammer.
I'm just going to read this. Can I just read this two paragraphs?
Yeah. Okay. Yes, please.
When Zuckerberg was a junior in high school, he transferred to Phillips Exeter Academy, where he spent most of his time coding, fencing, and studying Latin. Ancient Rome became a lifelong fascination, first because of the language, quote, it's very much like coding or math, and I so appreciated that, and then because of the history. Zuckerberg told me, quote, you have all these good and bad and complex figures. I think Augustus is one of the most fascinating. Basically, through a really harsh approach, he established a 200 years of world. He established 200 years of world peace. For non-classics majors, Augustus Caesar, born in 63 BC, staked his claim to power at the age of 18 and turned Rome from a republic into an empire by conquering Egypt, northern Spain, and large parts of central Europe. He also eliminated political opponents, banished his daughter for promiscuity, and was suspected of arranging the execution of his grandsons. Quote, what are the trade-offs in that? Zuckerberg said, growing animated. On the one hand, world peace is a long-term goal that people talk about today. 200 years feels unattainable. On the other hand, he said, that didn't come for free, and he had to do certain things. In 2012, Zuckerberg and Chan spent their honeymoon in Rome. He later said, quote, my wife was making fun of me, saying she thought all of... She's saying that she thought there were three people on the honeymoon, me, her, and Augustus. All of the photos were of different sculptures of Augustus. The couple named their second daughter August. Extremely okay. Good pair of paragraphs. Extremely poor understanding of history. And
Rob
maybe is, what
Rob
the,
looks
the
very
world,
upset.
What's the world mean, Rob? What's it mean to have world peace?
That, God, there's a lot of things here. Okay.
I feel like that section, I read that but thinking, I can't
so
wait
telling.
Till Rob reads that section.
Yes.
It's a really fucking weird section. Like, first of all, like, how can one be so into Augustus, but actually know so little about him? This is like no Roman historian, even your most committed, like, Western
like
chauvinist would say that, like, ah, yes, Pax Romana, world peace. That wasn't the world, man. That
right.
wasn't the fucking world. And the empire, so even within like, okay, within the Roman world there was peace. Not on the margins there weren't. Uh-oh. And those margins were pretty fucking extensive and they were pretty fucking movable. That's the nature of the empire he built. Like, literally,
yes.
It was constant warfare on the borders. Like, it's not world peace. The other part of this is this notion that he seems really fixated on.
Yeah.
And I understand, like, the temptation of it, because, like, if you pose the hypothetical, it's a very Machiavellian proposal. Like, do you be gentle and moderate, or do you cut some fucking throats in order to permanently solve a problem, and things are going to be fine? I've always had, like, being, like, someone who, like, likes Machiavelli probably way too much, I've always had some sympathy for the argument, but the thing is, that's never actually what you accomplish. Like,
right.
You're never going to get that, one person will suffer, but millions will live in peace. That's never the bargain. It's never even close to the bargain you're offered. And so the Augustus model, this idea that he did certain things, but it worked out for the greater good, I think that's much more contested than you think, my guy. Like, right. He did a lot of those certain things. The regime he founded did a lot of those certain things across the next several lifetimes. Like, his successors did a lot of certain things. And the certain things never stayed as constrained as you might think.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, the study of history is not like math or coding, so you're not going to get any of that from Mark Zuckerberg. The point of the margins, again, like, I'm going to come back to this in 30 minutes or whatever, but, like, and in the wake of the news about climate change stuff, right? Like, so much of this vision of democracy and of technologically guided progress is built around a very small idea of the world, of who counts. We're doing this series of podcasts on The Purge right now, as everyone on this call knows, and maybe if you're listening, you haven't listened to those yet. But believe it or not, this is a major part of our conversations around The Purge, too. It's like, when a policy gets put in place, who is the assumed benefactor of that policy? And it's often not policies. It's often worldviews. It's often ideologies that, at their very, very basic first step, say, here is what we believe the world to be. And everything falls from that. And if the world is too small, if your vision of the world is, as Mark Zuckerberg seems to be, like the people he talks to at Facebook and that he meets on his weird I'm going to meet real people tour of America.
Oh my God. Like, which is like, remember when people were saying Mark Zuckerberg is going to run for office?
I still think he might run. I still think he might. I still think
I want him to, because he would fail so spectacularly.
I can't believe you said that on. It's going to happen now, Patrick.
Now it's going to happen, and he's going to win.
Wouldn't you?
It's going to be terrible.
I want to see that robot get up on stage and talk policy.
But that's the thing, is like, so much of what the ideology that guides Facebook, that makes them think like, ah, it's fine. What's the quote that he uses when he adds the timeline and people are like, hey, no more timeline.
Take a breath.
Breathe.
The news feed, yeah, which like people forget was. Like, now it just seems like, oh, that was part of Facebook forever. And it's like, no, people revolted. There were marches in the street outside of their office. And yeah, he posted a thing that was told people to breathe, which kind of gave a sense that, oh, maybe they're going to pull this back. But it was part of, like, there's this part of this ideology that's, you know, laid out very succinctly in the piece and is coded in Zuckerberg and how he treats everything at Facebook and the response to criticism to Facebook, which is like, basically. He says, give it enough time, people will adjust. I think what the article suggests, especially when it starts scratching at the psychology of Facebook and its users, not so much about Facebook's psychology, is that people are addicted to it. Right. And so do they accept it, or does it just become normalized because you have no other choice but to keep using the service, and that you can make all the change you want, even if it's dangerous change, and people will adapt, well, because you've addicted them for all sorts of other reasons, and where else are they supposed to go?
Totally.
Something I was thinking about as I read this is there's a couple like good environmental advocacy groups in my area. Their only pages are on Facebook. There's no other way to get in touch with them. No other way to like reach out and say like, hey, how do I participate in this and like organize around this? That has to be done through Facebook. And as long as that's the reality for a whole bunch of like useful human activities and connections, Facebook is going to remain an extremely double-edged sword at best. And this piece does not paint a picture of a person or an organization capable of reckoning with that in a meaningful way. But hey, not everything is bad. Sometimes things are awesome and worthy of consuming. And that's why we're going to take a little break here.
Oh my God.
To pay some bills. I'm feeling reasonably confident in this week's ad. Next week's, who the fuck knows?
But yeah, we're looking into it. No, we're
this
into
ad, though, maybe. Anyway, here's an ad.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Well, that was great. Anyway.
God damn it, Rob.
It's going to be an ad for Facebook Messenger or something.
Oh, it has to be.
Well, first of all, what makes you think there was an ad there in the first place?
Right. Like, who knows? Maybe the algorithm didn't choose you for an ad, in which case, congratulations.
Maybe all the people heard was complete silence. Danielle.
Complete silence.
Talk to me about this week's Waypoint.
All right. So, friends, I meant to watch Channel Zero's new season last week. The screeners didn't work, however, so I watched A Quiet Place. Boy, do I have thoughts on A Quiet Place. Some of them are good and some of them are bad. I'm going to tell you the general through line here is that it was beautifully shot. The lighting and framing throughout convey tension beautifully. And my God, did I hate some of the characters in this movie.
Can you set it up?
Horrible, terrible decisions.
I still haven't seen this. I know the basic gist, but just in case someone doesn't.
So the movie opens. Beautiful. Again, it's beautifully shot. Really, truly beautifully shot. And it's silent at this part of the movie. It's not a silent film, actually. There's a lot of diegetic noise, noise that's in the world of the film. And also there's a musical score and there are some spoken lines. But it is by and large a quiet movie because in this world, top line, there is a world of monsters who are attracted by noise. So anyone who survives in this world needs to be extremely, extremely quiet. They can't talk. They walk around barefoot. Any kind of object that can make any noise could attract a killer, horrifying monster, basically. It begins with this sort of beautiful, eerie, gorgeous scene. It's fall in New England, and a family is in a town. They kind of walk into a country store or a pharmacy or something like that. They get medicine for the youngest member of the family, a little boy. He's about 4 years old. They walk out. There's this beautiful shot that says, "It's sound." There's like a newspaper flapping in the wind that has a headline that says, "It's sound." And it's like, oh, this is really nice kind of environmental storytelling is what you would call it in a game. But obviously in a movie, it's just all sort of the mise-en-scene. Using that word today, I guess. quickly something really bad happens that shows you what happens when tremendous sound is made. That was on day 89. Then the movie kind of jumps to day 432 or something like that. It's only about a little over a year after.
But long enough for this to become like kind of the normal that people are starting to just live with.
Exactly. And it focuses on this family. Director and also lead actor John Krasinski is the dad. I'm sure he has
so
a name.
It's so weird that he's...
His turn to action star, which I've resisted.
Yep.
Completely. But The Quiet Place makes a good argument for it.
I hated him. Like, every second okay. He was in this movie, I hated this man. I'm sorry. I'm very sorry. And a lot of that has to do with sort of the gender politics of this movie, which I might go into a little bit further down the line. But generally, the sort of two leads, it's him and Emily Blunt, his real-life partner.
So the movie has to be good.
His wife.
Like, Emily Blunt movies are kind of by law. Like, they have to be good.
I really like a lot of things about A Quiet Place. I really do. I genuinely do. I think it is beautiful, intense.
Is Emily Blunt not one of those things?
No, Emily Blunt is fantastic.
Okay.
Yeah.
I felt like you were winding up to break some news to me, like, Rob. Like,
no.
Emily Blunt milkshake ducks in the middle of this movie.
I just really question. Now, look, I love horror movies more than most things in this world. Like, horror movies are in like my top 10 of things that make me want to live mm-hmm. life and mm-hmm. get up and get
I'm
out
with
there.
You on that deep irony.
See? However, normally, I'm not bothered by how stupid people are in horror movies. Normally, I have a lot of sympathy for, like, okay, you're in a bad place. A bad thing happened to you. You're in a bad place. You're making a bad decision.
No, they're in a quiet place.
That's a sequel.
They're in a quiet place.
Sequel is
it's
a bad
place too. But it's also a quiet place, yeah.
It looks quaint. I don't know. I've seen the trailer.
It's
their house
beautiful.
Is very, that doesn't seem like a bad place.
It's beautiful. It's New England in the fall.
Oh,
or maybe
hell yeah.
I think it's upstate New York. Okay, it's
almost
upstate New York
thing,
in the fall.
Except way less good, but like still.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, similar biome.
Less coastal stuff, you know? Yeah, exactly. However, and I'm very, very sorry, but I'm gonna say a thing. This is going to it's going to spoil the after the first 10 minutes of the movie.
Yeah.
Mom and dad made the decision after the death of a child to have another baby in this world. They decided to bring a screaming monster into an unpredictable screaming creature into a world where any noise above a heartbeat will get everyone killed.
Wait.
Yeah.
I mean, did the Pope change his mind on birth control? As is one of those situations?
There were condoms in that pharmacy. All right?
Oh,
there was plenty
of
merchandise on the shelf.
So wait. Hold on.
But Danielle, but okay, yes. Yeah. Yes. The arguments for why they do it are questionable. But the way the story addresses the consequences of that action are so much fun.
I know.
Like, it is worth the logical leap. I would argue it's worth the logical leap. I'm going to spoil something else about the movie, right?
Okay.
So when, which is related to her point, and I don't
want to
get too
ahead if you want no spoilers.
Yeah.
I'm just going to say.
I'm spoiling
it
this.
It seems
movie.
Like this is
yeah.
going to be, which I'm fine with. As a person, I'm totally fine with it. But I just
it's
want
just,
to let people
so
say
So just to justify why I went along with that leap. I have like some emotional sympathy for it as a parent.
Sure.
That is probably irrational because I think parents are like forced to be irrational because that's part of coded into your DNA as parents once you have a kid, like is a certain amount of rationality. But so it's revealed like, well, how are you going to deal with this screaming kid? Because the way that horror movies tend to deal with screaming kids is they conveniently get quiet when they're supposed to. And then they conveniently make a noise when it's like, you know, it will be tense for the plot. And it's like, well, you know, Quiet Place realizes, well, okay, that can't really work because kids scream. And so it's revealed that in their basement, the way to deal with this child who's going to be screaming at all times is that for most of the child's, I don't know, first year of its life, it will have to live in a coffin in which they have conceived of a breathing apparatus that is goes in there so that the child can breathe.
Metaphor.
Otherwise, it lives in its coffin. It's so good. Like, it's just like, sure.
Do they feed it
that's
in there
a way
too?
You could do it.
How do they feed
okay.
it?
There's
you
a
take,
lot of things.
Well, you're taking out the
babies
taking
tend
out
to
the
be
baby.
Quiet when they're being fed.
Okay, yes. fair.
True.
I mean, I don't know if the noise of feeding, is that too much for the, like, it's not
that's,
established.
That's the thing. So,
why do they
this is a movie where
the
gimmick
basement?
Is a lot.
Okay.
What's up?
Yeah, this is a good question. Why can't you just soundproof your house?
Sorry to get Tactical Tuesday on y'all.
Like, fucking
probably
no,
soundproofing
the
house would itself make noise.
It's all right.
I guess so.
Oh, yeah. You probably can't.
There is a scene in this movie. Okay. Let's get to the gender politics a little
Please.
Bit. Because it's
sure.
related to the sort of family dynamic going on here. And it's related to probably the decision to have a baby. I think it's sort of implied that they're having this baby to replace another child. That's a little bit of kind of what's going on here. It's the way things are shot. It's like, okay, we're cutting from a bad thing happening to like, okay, there's a baby bump on Emily Blunt. Like, all right. Okay, I see what's going on here. There's an absence and a presence, and that's what we're doing. Okay. And it's also implied that they are a religious family. They pray silently before eating. So I think between those two things, that's kind of what's going on here. And there's a very traditional sort of family dynamic. Dad is very much the leader. Mom, who was a doctor, I think, possibly a nurse, possibly an EMT or something, but she has medical training. She knows how to use, like, she's taking her own blood pressure to and tracking, like, when the baby was probably conceived and, like, when the due date is and all these kinds of things. So these are not, like, I don't know, they're not, like, simple country folk the way they are dressed and sort of walking through the world. These are people with expertise, certainly. But they, oh, my God, yeah. Okay. There's a scene where dad is going to teach the little boy whose name, I'm sorry, I forgot the other little boy's name. He's going to teach him how to fish. He does not take the little girl who wants to go. Reagan is the girl. And Reagan is a deaf character. Reagan, and it's also implied this is why the family knows sign language, because Reagan was already hard of hearing or deaf. So they all learned sign language so they could communicate with her effectively. Dad doesn't bring her. A, because she's a girl, and B, because, yeah, they're going fishing, but this is also secretly the man scream area, because next to the river, it's loud, and then the waterfall, you can scream. So Reagan misses out because she is both a girl and because she's hard of hearing or deaf. And it's very, like, at that point, from then on, I hated the dad. I just hated this asshole. How could you do this? How could you treat your children so completely differently? And also, you're putting them in danger by making another baby and introducing this into the world. Like, your kids are fucked if that baby cries. Like, your whole family is fucked at that point. Like, it just felt so ridiculously selfish and in a very, very gendered way that really bothered me on so many levels. Also, again, I agree with you, Patrick, that the gimmick is good, and you really do have to make a few sort of leaps here of disbelief. But put your house next to the waterfall, and you all
oh,
have
damn.
A better chance of surviving. I'm sorry.
That
okay, I know.
A good
okay.
idea.
gimmicks. I know. You got to kind of go with
it. Well, the waterfall would be a problem. Because they also show that like the ruffling of leaves is enough to set off the creatures. And so like when they walk from the town back to their house, they've created paths full of sand so that you're creating the, I mean, again, like it's the rules of this world are like fungible in a way that you kind of just have to go along with. Like it's a movie that like does not hold up under plot scrutiny very well, but it has its best experience like the first time. Like there are movies that like I get better with like repeated viewings, and you can like appreciate different things about them. Like I doubt this is one of them, but it is a. I don't disagree at all with you like on some of the politics of the movie and how it handles certain characterizations. But I think it also sounds like you agree that like it's incredibly tense and like super fun and well shot, and like it's a good horror movie, but like it doesn't rise much above like genre fare.
Yeah, definitely, and I really, really appreciated some elements. I actually thought Emily Blunt was great. There are scenes where she sure is the toughest person in this movie by a long shot. And she goes through some things. And it's just like really good, pure adrenaline horror. Like, oh man, I mean, the bad thing.
She must have a baby in this movie, right?
She does.
Uh-huh.
That's a loud thing. I've heard that.
Yep.
About
is it Austin still okay? Austin,
it's accounted for.
Austin's still back at the conceit. He's still like, wait, but what about like, nope, coffin, sand passages?
Does she have the baby in the coffin?
No,
that would be very heavy-handed.
That would be
welcome to your world of climate change,
cradle
child.
To grave.
At that point, I think I'd have to say this movie knows what bringing a baby in is, right? God.
And of course, it is a metaphor, right? Like, of course, it's a heavy-handed metaphor, but like,
What is it? So again, I have not seen this yet. I've not had the time yet. I had to choose between The Purge and The Quiet Place last night, and I chose The Purge.
You chose The Purge,
so we can do that podcast. What is the what are the big picture metaphors like coming through this? Besides, like, the family out on its own in the woods doing some...
Yeah, family out on its own in the woods. I think the terror probably of bringing a child into the world at all. I think that's what this is kind of a metaphor for. Like, it's a dangerous, horrifying, bad world. But if you want to have a child and love it and grow it up in a nurturing way, you have to make all these concessions, and it's dangerous, and there's no guarantees.
Gotta
and
build
sort
a coffin,
the
baby coffin. Yeah,
you got a baby coffin that they've outfitted with oxygen. They didn't have the right size mask for an infant, but it's all right. I'm not gonna. Okay, you know, that's a nitpick.
Well,
that doesn't count as an actual criticism of the movie.
I had somehow not like realized this was an Emily Blunt movie, so like I think I have to like now I'm angry I didn't watch it. To get ready for it, because I love me some Emily Blunt. Like, I love Emily Blunt to the point where I've seen The Adjustment Bureau more than once.
I still have to see that.
Oh, wow!
I want to see that.
Austin, you should see The Adjustment Bureau, and, like, it's not good, but, like, it's real good.
Okay.
She's good in it.
Yeah, it's...
That's the thing. She's good in this movie. She's great. I think she's great in this movie. Like, it's not the most satisfying role, but she does a hell of a lot in a basically silent role as basically mom woman, you know, it's like kind of what's going on here.
Mom woman,
she was a doctor or something. I mean, there are like vestiges of people's roles before this sort of hell time. There's a lot going on there, and my God, yeah, it's so beautifully shot. There's ways in which the framing and the lighting just do absolute wonders for like selling the tension. I don't actually think it was a very scary movie. Like on the old scare meter, it was much more tense than it was scary. It was much more.
But
like,
but it never lets up that tension once it starts. Yeah. Like there's a protracted, like once the movie goes, like it waits a long time to sort of go, and then once the moment it pivots, I actually found the tension to be more enjoyable than like traditional scares, because you are just like on the edge of your seat. And you want to? I've never heard a theater be as quiet, at like you know, to literally like where people were actually in some ways role playing the film, because there were moments where it was just dead ass silent. And it was a movie that's unfortunate that you like, if either of you get around to watching it, like I'm a big stay at home and watch movie person. I advocate for that, but this is one of those movies that benefits deeply from like a big ass screen, and if more importantly, just really good sound. If you don't have a good speaker set, watch it with headphones.
I'm covered.
Yeah, I think that's super fair. Rob, I actually One day this could be your waypoint too, because I'm very curious what you think of it too, especially on the blunt scale, you know.
Yeah, like Edge of Tomorrow and Sicario. Like, yeah. Although, where do I put Sicario these days? Who knows? Who knows? Day of the Soldado.
Rob,
anyway.
Have you seen? I watched that second one.
I haven't seen that yet.
I have not seen it.
Austin,
do I need to see this?
You need to. Yes, we need to.
Fuck that has to be next week because okay. Austin, you're gonna be gone.
I'll be gone.
But
I'll get around to it.
All right, Day of the Soldado.
Need to watch.
Does it Sicario 2?
We missed the point, y'all.
Yeah, that's my question.
Same screenwriter.
That's so weird. I don't know.
You have to watch it.
All right, I'm on a plane this weekend. Maybe I'll get to see it there.
While you're on that plane, Austin, are you going to be perchance listening to any good podcasts about urban history?
I might be. I've been in the middle of listening to a new podcast from, of all places, USA Today, which is not, I didn't realize they had a podcast team, but apparently they do. And I've been listening to a podcast called The City, which pitches itself let me see, I'm trying to see if they have like a really good, here's what the podcast is, breakdown. Here it is. This is, it's spring, 1990. After years of disinvestment, highways are rebuilt, old buildings demolished, new skyscrapers erected. All that rubble has to go somewhere, and its destination isn't a landfill. It's a pair of vacant lots in a black, working-class neighborhood called North Lawndale. The man behind this operation is a white guy sporting a Cosby sweater and underworld connections. What follows is a tour de force through Chicago's underbelly. Aldermen get indicted, an FBI investigation goes awry, a community's resilience is tested, all unfolding under the specter of racism in America. So it is a six-part mini-series podcast. I've listened to three of the episodes so far. The fourth
they're
one,
shortish.
They're shortish. They're like 30 minutes.
Like 30
long
to 40 minutes.
Yeah, totally.
Put that on 1.5x.
You run through it. You get through it immediately. I think the fourth one just came out this week. The fifth one is next week. So you plenty of time to catch up to it. And honestly, even if you just give the first two episodes a listen, I think you've gotten a good taste of what's so interesting about this show. You know, I went into the show expecting it to feel like shows like Crime Town, other shows about corruption and crime in urban America and government. And I was immediately struck by who gets to speak and who gets to speak first in this show. I think that's why I think it's worth a listen. You know, this is the second podcast I brought, right? What was the other one that I brought?
Serial,
right? And I think in a similar way that we talked about Serial kind of correcting some of its past mistakes around looking at it, kind of ignoring the victims of the kind of scandalous and spectacular crimes that it focused on in the first season. I think this does a good job of shifting what I've seen in this style of podcast before. By specifically, again, one opening on the residents of North Lawndale who found themselves facing a 6-story tall mountain of debris, of rock, of cement, of rebar, of just dirt in the middle of their community across from a school.
What is the time frame in this again?
This is the 90s during Chicago restoration project,
right. Gotcha.
Which Mayor Daley, who came in, you know, Jesus Christ, go read about the Dailies. That's a whole separate.
Very common.
Illinois politics is a whole separate podcast. Totally. That'll be our separate. We're going to talk about Illinois politics. corruption, basically.
But that is
They were renovating the downtown. They were putting in all of this like very aesthetic looking stuff while also investing in the highways and like basically trying to like find a Chicago 2.0, like building up the infrastructure, making it an attractive place to live. Illinois has had a problem for decades of folks leaving to cheaper
flight,
states like
basically.
Wisconsin and Indiana. And so that's the, like, it's part of it. It's contextualized in a spot when, Illinois is like, or Chicago specifically, is like becoming like a new city, and like it's getting cleaner and prettier and updated.
Right. That is the, for me, that is the thing that makes this so fascinating, is there's a quote from Robin Amer in the first episode. Robin Amer is the host, and she says, "When a city gets rebuilt, it puts its new skyscrapers and parks and monuments front and center. It doesn't always want you to see how those things got built or who got hurt in the process." And I've been thinking so much lately about global warming, as we've talked about the fate of democracy in the world, about the state of kind of this weird technological progressivism that believes that like the way forward is a few good apps and like some new clean eco-science that's going to save us all. And this show is like a perfectly timed reminder that there is always a margin, because when you look at the stuff that you know Mayor Daley was doing here in this moment, it is like Patrick said, all of the stuff that made downtown Chicago look like a modern city, a city
the
that
the Bean,
right? The Bean is like the best example of this. The Bean is like this sculpture, this
still
this
copyright
giant
as
silver,
as though a giant took a shit somewhere and then they
oh,
shined
don't be
it
mean
real.
To Cloudgate.
I love the bean, but come on.
But that is the thing. It's like, okay, well, when you're cleaning up this neighborhood, when you're cleaning up these places, and you're literally, you know, destroying old buildings and creating parks, where does the trash go? And the answer is that a man named John Christopher, who runs a company named Chris John, snuck in and said, "You know what? If you take this to a real dump, they're gonna charge you $150 a load. I got this property right here next to the school. You can unload it for $10 a load." And you know, who cares? It's a black district at a time when the kind of non-democratic machine, kind of insider politicians were out of power. The people who could have represented the black folks in that neighborhood were in fact in many cases working with the white establishment and being used by the white establishment. A complete failure to actually protect these people. Some fantastic scenes over the course of this podcast that get at that notion that like someone is always on the outside. Someone, regardless of how wide you cast your net, like someone is out of, and this is going back to the Zuckerberg piece, your conception of the world. And it isn't enough to say, "I want to make things better in what I think is the world." You constantly have to think, okay, I'm going to make, you have to do the Augustus thing that Zuckerberg believes Augustus did, and actually think and research and look into who will be hurt by these policies, what are the decisions I'm making, and like how do I go forward at all in a way that actually achieves my goals with, you know, where the costs are something I can live with and something that actually does not harm people in a huge way. And I don't know, I was fascinated throughout the episodes I've heard so far, and especially at the sequences in which you know, the procedurality of working inside of city government comes around and bites you in the ass. There is a fantastic sequence in which there is a reenactment of a court scene where there is a debate over what counts as waste.
Wow.
So this actually really jumped out at me because, first of all, it is legitimately Kafkaesque. This guy is dumping piles of shit into this neighborhood. And the other thing is, like, the scale of it is kind of almost ridiculous in that, like, it's such a small-time racket. Like, $150 a real dump. This guy's saving, what, $140 per load? Eventually that adds up, but even thinking about it, it's like, man, what a nickel and dimey, like, scheme this is. But, like, this is the shit you can get away with, and there are people in the world, there are actors in the world, who are going to look at that $140 off the book, or, you know, they're going to misbill. And to them, done on a big enough scale, that's money worth stealing. But they take this guy to court, and from the first, like, the city lawyer is like, "Well, you're running a waste site in Lawndale," and the guy's like, "I don't know what you're talking about." And they're like, "Well, you're dumping," and his lawyer's like, no, what do you mean by waste? No, like, well, concrete, rebar. He's like, "You mean materials? I recycle this stuff. That stuff has value to my business. I will not answer any questions you have. Like, if you say the word waste, I don't know what you're talking about, so I'm not going to answer them.
Be specific.
Yeah.
Say rebar. Say concrete."
And It also ties into something. This is a problem with regulatory enforcement pretty much across the board. There was an, I think it was a SEC lawyer, it might have been FTC lawyer, so either Securities Exchange or Federal Trade Commission, talking about whenever you have legal cases, that the first hurdle they have to clear are what you call water is wet tests. You are not regulating enough. You are not being legally aggressive enough. Because if you're going to a court and you have to first prove that, like, water is wet for the case to move forward, then you're never going to get anywhere. You're never going to improve anyone's lives. You're never actually going to accomplish the ends of your organization. This is a perfect example of that. This guy pulls this little semantic game. And the court is kind of tickled by it. They're like, holy shit. Maybe it isn't waste. And they refuse to grant the injunction that would stop this guy from doing this while he continues to do it, while he continues to dump. So with no injunction, he just keeps going.
It's brutal. It's like it's you know, there's a bit in which it becomes clear that he describes himself as a beautifier and recycler and finds ways to make that true based on legal definitions of what counts as recycling. It doesn't matter that most of what he has isn't actually recyclable. A little bit of it is, so he's a recycler. It doesn't matter that no one's been hired to do any recycling. He's a recycler because it's recyclable material that he's dumping. It might one day get recycled. Who could say? It is fascinating. Patrick, do you have any insight as being someone in this area and, like, having in the 90s, you were around certainly, but I doubt you were,
yeah,
you were five,
I, well,
or something, right?
Unfortunately, and probably familiar with this dynamic of, like, I tell people I'm from Chicago, but right. I'm not from Chicago, you know, say, like, I'm from the Northwest suburbs.
Right.
When I moved back, I got so used to telling people I was from Chicago, as the shorthand. And then I got back and I was telling people I'm from Chicago. They're like, no, you're not. You're from blah, 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 you
right.
asshole.
Right.
And I lived in Chicago for a couple of years. But, it's not – you don't have to scratch very far down the surface of Chicago – like, Chicago politics has been – and this isn't something that goes back to, like, the gangster era. Like, this is – like modern Chicago, like, you know, are the governor, you know, go read up on Blagojevich,
right?
Like,
right.
The,
God, I
you know, our governors have, you know, our governors,
Jesus.
Our mayors go, wait, what wasn't it back to back governors we had go to jail?
Mm-hmm.
I think that was the case. And Blagojevich now even infects our current politics because J.B. Pritzker, our shitty rich dude, Ostwald progressive, who is up for the Democratic nomination, like, is on a bunch of tapes with Blagojevich, like, talking about, you know, wheeling and dealing back when it's just Illinois is fucked. Go read about his politics.
Right.
Like, none of this is surprising. Certainly all sorts of politics are corrupt, but, like, Chicago has a very on-brand style of corruption that is fascinating and infuriating. And, like, so when you pinged me, Austin, about this podcast, like, I looked at the description, but, like, it didn't process. Like, I didn't notice that it was, like, said Chicago.
Yeah.
And the moment I saw that, then I was like, oh, fuck. And then started downloading. So I haven't listened to the first episode, but I'm super excited. And one thing this does really well that I think the Serial Season 3 is also doing well is, like, making sure to provide the participants.
That's exactly
it. That were in these actions have a voice. That's not always possible, right? Like, is Serial... the most recent episode of Serial's, you know, Season 3, which is, you know, dealing in the prison system and specifically a court system... There are, like, instances where, you know, Sarah Koenig, the reporter, has to, like, outline, like, these people just won't talk to me.
Yeah.
And so, like, outlining where you cannot provide voices, but not using that as an excuse to then just not find ways to get voices in. And I think this at least this first episode, seems like it's a podcast that has picked an angle in which they can make sure not just read you a Wikipedia entry,
right.
but they can give actual articulated voice to people who participated in a process that – achieve an outcome.
It is immediately speaking to, like, the black women of this neighborhood,
yeah.
who
nice.
Were the women who organized, who petitioned, who tried to do, who tried to get their alderman to fix anything.
First episode, and so the cliffhanger is basically, like, we're gonna sue his ass.
Yeah, 100%. It's so good. And, you know, that is so important to me, partially because of the way Chicago has become mythologized by the right as a place of urban dysfunction.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically the argument that comes out, you know, this is obviously not about direct gun violence, let's say, but there is the conversation that does emerge by the third episode that is like, the podcast veers towards like a broken window theory of politics at certain moments where it's like, well, this it's different because the broken window theory, I should explain this, broken window theory of crime is effectively that, like, well, if you have a community that keeps itself looking nice and you make sure that, like, you fix your windows when it break, when they break, it sends a signal to evildoers that this is not the place that they can fuck with. It sends a message of security and of law abiding and that you care about
aesthetic as policy.
Exactly. 100%. And so this podcast does take the case, and I suspect that the stats do support this, that, like, when there is a multiple football field long, six story high pile mountain of trash, There are you know, effects. There's a rise in crime. You know, they talk about the rise in open prostitution on the street and things like that. In a way that I think sometimes does not land particularly well. Like, there's some hard shifts from, like, we're talking to real people to, like, okay, but the prostitutes aren't real people, so we're not going to interview anyone who's involved in that side of things. But there is still an important distinction there, which is that the broken window theory is about you as an individual. You are the one who has to repair your window. And this is very much about a government, you know, completely deciding not to take care of people who have been, whether literally or only in process, been turned into second class citizens. I think that's an important distinction. But I do think that there is something really fascinating here around the – it isn't just like who gets to speak and who gets to tell that story. It is also the ways in which, with years of remove, you only then can kind of see who was to be – who was at fault, right? The show does a good job of doubling back on itself and saying, like, okay – it seems like this dude sold out his community, but we're going to build the context, and this is the bulk of the third episode. We're going to build the context of what the Chicago political system is, what the insiders and the kind of regular Democrats are versus the kind of, like, independent Democrats are, where the black community is versus the white community of Democrats. Everyone here is voting Democrat, but that does
mean people aren't aware that Illinois is essentially a one party state. Like, there are Republicans, but they have very little. We have a Republican governor, but that's a rarity, and he's definitely not going to win re-election. That was more of a – like, him winning was more of a just, like, a fuck you to the Democratic establishment as a way of just, like, changing things up. But, like, Illinois is just Democrats through and through, totally. And then shades of Democrat.
And then it becomes –
you want centrists, come to Illinois is what I'm saying.
Absolutely. So, I mean, and then the thing that works so well with that is, like, because you recognize that there is this nuance there and you're giving time for that nuance because it doesn't have to be an aside, it also means that you can get not just into the nuance but into, like, the real material detail of lives. There's this perfect detail early on that just – it's a small thing, but it's like – one of the women is talking about, like, we don't have air conditioners. So when there's all this dust particle shit in the air, like – we just have box fans in the windows blowing it all in. There's no filter. There's nothing. And just, like, right, there's no air conditioners. That's such a small detail that so many listeners would not consider the idea of just, like, the box fan blowing in this dust, you know, leading to potentially a spike in asthma, a spike in respiratory conditions in general. It is a fairly strong show at grounding things in both those material concerns and also finding the room to explain the nuance of a system that, like, if you're not from Chicago, all of these terms that have all this meaning, if they didn't sit down and explain them, it would just kind of go over your head and you'd miss so much of what makes the story so remarkable.
Something that I'm not sure the show is going to have an answer to. Curious, but, like, and I certainly don't have an answer for it, but it's a question I think worth contemplating as we sort of wrap up for this week, is what do you do? Like, a lot of our system, our society, while backed in the end by the idea of the force of law, depends on people roughly doing the right thing, being decent actors.
Yeah.
What do you do in a case where somebody just openly, like, decides to flout the law, like, flout good manners convention, anything, just looks you dead in the eye as you make your airtight case that what they're doing is harmful and wrong and they don't even have the right to do it. It is what they're doing is criminal. And they know all this and they just look at you and they tell you, fuck out of here. right? They like literally that's what they that's literally what he tells the community leaders. But yeah. like, what do you do when somebody
they say we're going to take you to court, and he basically threatens them.
Yeah,
and says, yeah, okay,
yeah,
go for it, fuck off.
And this community tries to address this through the system. And the system is also not really prepared to deal. System's not prepared to deal with somebody who's going to be so brazen as to say, waste? I don't deal in waste. It doesn't comprehend what it's dealing with here. And so a situation becomes a crisis. And I don't know, like, this is a tragedy to a degree of, like, a city failing a community and a system failing a community and a lot of, like, the system being slow and ineffective. But also there's a question I'm starting to sort of turning over is, at a certain point, is a guy like that somebody who's going to sit there and be like, fuck you, make me? At a certain point, do you need to find another way to make that guy?
Also, what happens when that guy is Mark Zuckerberg?
Yeah.
Right? Like, what happens when that guy is not just like a two-bit criminal who's trying to make $140 on a $10 turn, right? Or whatever yeah. it is that this guy's making, really. What is it when it's someone who has more money than any of us could actually comprehend having? The amount of money that Facebook has, the amount of money that like the true 1%
or Amazon
has.
Amazon or Apple.
Or yeah, Apple. I mean, there's that big stat. Four in the, right. Yeah. The big four have a higher GDP than France is the quote in the piece. But I mean, even just Facebook alone has a higher GDP than many countries do. And in a world in which, you know, the world is a capitalist society still, you buy stuff and there are fewer and fewer protections against sort of shaping the political reality of our time with money than there ever have been, partially because of things Facebook has decided and pushed for. It is hard to comprehend dealing with a problem like a Mark Zuckerberg, because, you know, in a community like this, at some point you go like, well, fuck it, like, we got to get rid of this guy.
Yeah,
I don't know what we do, but we got to push this guy out of here. Maybe that is through intimidation or threats or violence. At like, there's a point at which that stuff, or, you know, eventually it's just, you know, begging the city again and again and again and putting you completely overturning the city political system so that one of your people is in charge finally who yeah. can take a stance. There are lots of ways to do that stuff when it is a dude with a lot. The thing that is terrifying is that, like, I don't know how do you today, let's say we wanted to outlaw Facebook. What's the platform we would have to spread that message on? Facebook, right? Facebook or television. Neither of those are really useful for us.
Carrier pigeon.
You know, I feel like I haven't subscribed. Yeah. Right? Basically. We're saying this as people who have access to a platform. Like, we know that tens of thousands of people are probably listening to us right now. So we're trying to say that. We're trying to use our platform as best we can. But it's a drop in the bucket. It's nothing. The amount of people who, like, read or listen to voices like ours are nothing compared to those who control the platforms. And this goes back to what I was saying at the very top, which is like, when I think about this stuff intellectually, it is depressing and it is hard to imagine a world in which resistance achieves. But also you got to swing, right?
What's that story though about, like, was this in Harlem where like trash collection was like underserving the neighborhood? And people just started bringing their trash out into, like, the streets and blocking thoroughfares and, like, putting it on the, like, I feel like there was sort of a massive, like, this was a case, a somewhat similar situation of people just being like, fine, I'm bringing my problem to your fucking door.
Right. And well, you and I were just talking about this, right? Which is like, you and I, after in the long night of the beginning of this week, where neither of us slept, 2 days ago, reading about the new projections about climate change, we were talking about Occupy and about when Occupy had so much potential energy. And for me, it was every moment up until they moved into offices. While Occupy Wall Street functioned as a real political force was when it was disrupting physical space, when it was doing something that, like, annoyed people every day again and again and again, when it I'm not saying Occupy Wall Street does not have its issues that we could not criticize, absolutely. But I think that those are the sorts of strategies that appeal to me in 2018 are the ones that are about getting in the faces of people. I mean, we've all, I think, tweeted at this point that, like, we support people bothering senators at restaurants, you know, when they are. And if you're going to tweet at me that you were surprised that I would say such a thing, I suggest re-listening to every word I've ever said, because this is not a, should not be a surprise. Those are the strategies that have impact in 2018. Like, to answer your question, I guess, Rob, is like, yeah, the things that we need to do when the system has failed is to, you know, advocate for solutions and figure out solutions and figure out strategies to get eyeballs that have nothing to do with using the system, right?
Or, you know, I mean, you know, obviously Kavanaugh made it through, but, like, there was a very critical moment where an activist, like, cornered him in an elevator yep. and bravely told her story and, you know, by all accounts, got him to change his mind at the very last second. It didn't stave off, you know, the inevitable, but that was someone bucking the traditional
yes.
manners. That it was bucking ideas of civility and discourse and saying, fuck you, listen to me, and basically grabbing him by the collar
yeah.
and saying, you're going to look at me and you're going to listen.
Those
and
women would not have been hurt if they'd called his office or sent a letter.
Because, no, or went on because, CNN,
right?
Right? Like, or wrote an editorial. And it shows up in the op-ed section of the New York Times. Like, that's just not how it works anymore. And when those avenues no longer work, and you have to press in new ways in order to try and, you know, make it clear, you know, what your position is.
People still get upset when you get in the streets, is the thing I'll say. Mm-hmm. They really still do. And it is worth continuing to pursue it.
As long as we live in physical bodies,
yeah.
occupy physical space,
yeah.
that is still a...
You know, I think we will live in the age of I think we're going to live in the age of eco-terrorism and in the age of I can imagine the world in which some people take down fucking Amazon servers in physical space sometime in our lives as a form of protest. Like, I can so clearly imagine that happening. You know, we talked about Tom Clancy briefly at the top of this, and I the first time
Rainbow
Clancy
Six.
Book I read is was Rainbow Six, which is a book about eco-terrorists and taking down these radical eco-terrorists who, you know, in the rearview mirror here, with the benefit of hindsight, whew, maybe they were in the right. I don't remember what the specific instance was or the specific issue of
that
book.
They were going to release a bioplay that was going to extinguish human life on Earth, but they were caricatures of the environmental movement,
yes,
like fundamentally.
Yeah, exactly.
Not all environmentalists.
Yeah, at least they didn't invent Facebook, right?
Yeah.
Right. So I think that we're going to live in that time, and it's going to be very weird, and it's going to be like, it's going to be strange, because I think for many of us, those forms of action have been mythologized.
There's an element. The thing that's going to be tough to handle with this is in our discourse. There's this idea that saying, like, having certain policies that radicalize and provoke terrorists, saying that, like, those policies create these problems, like the terrorist blowback is caused in part by policies you choose to pursue, harm you choose to mete out in the world. And every time that argument has been voiced, which is eminently sensible and, like, basic cause yeah. and effect, it's immediately presented in almost every context as, what are you doing apologizing for terrorists? What are you doing sympathizing for terrorists? And as long as our
discourse... And to be clear, what you're saying, just like to break it 100% down, what you're saying is that, like, if we get on Twitter, if we say on this podcast and we say, if someone tomorrow burns down an Amazon server farm, and we go like, yeah, we just did a podcast about how that was probably an inevitability based on the direction of society right now, people would then at that point say, you're defending violent action.
Right.
Right? As a way to shut down that discourse entirely.
Right. And I think that's going to be the trick to make those conversations the least bit productive, is to prevent that sort of centrist blocking of the conversation and ducking of the issue. Because what ends up happening in that situation is you end up in a situation where you're saying, well, you know, how dare you defend terrorists? Every time you say a policy of aggressive and unrelenting interventionism in the Middle East is causing terrorist incidents elsewhere in the world.
God.
If you even say that, you are somehow sympathizing or trying to, like, make excuses for attacks on civilians. And that basically forestalls any meaningful discussion of whether or not these policies are worth the cost of carrying them forward. Like, are these, like, forget like their moral defensibility. Frequently they're morally indefensible. But like, are they even accomplishing the ends that they purport to have? And you need to have those conversations. And having them blocked at the start every time by that line of argument is going to be a problem. And we are going to see this age of radical action being taken to address these problems. And to an extent, this is just like, it's a law of nature. Like, you can create like this much pressure in a system around these issues. There are going to be backlashes to that. And it's foolish not to discuss those costs up front and discuss them freely.
And we live in a world in which if we went to block a highway right now, if you know, in support of in protest of the, you know, the threat of retracting women's reproductive rights or new threats to, you
or
know, today,
abandonment of fuel efficiency standards.
Totally, 100%. Right now, if we were like, you know what, no cars move today, we're going to block this out right now, there would be a lot of people who would say that what we were doing was the wrong way about doing it, or going the wrong way about voicing that. You should be calling your
that
senator.
That argument would never go against the people who are jerking it to the idea of driving over our bodies in the street, by the way. Like, those not. People, mm-hmm. like, they're understood. Like, well, they're just, you know.
They're being hyperbolic, yeah. That's all. They're just saying they wish they could. They're not.
They would
actually
never do that except for those times they do.
Think about. Think about the when they do think it, yeah. about the truck driver you're stopping, Rob.
Right.
You know, think about the you're impacting commerce. On Main Street, they're suffering because you blocked the street for 4 hours last night.
Right.
And that is the sort of like false equivalency. And it also becomes the water is water wet argument again, right? The like, we're gonna sit here and start, we're gonna stop the debate at the way you're having it instead of engaging with the actual issues. We're gonna, instead of actually getting into like, all right, you're right. We should change the way we have environmental regulations in this country in ways that go beyond just tax incentives. That conversation can never happen because we're in this like rock and hard play situation. If we try to have that conversation by using the traditional means, the way that we've been doing for decades now, that conversation is shot down, is dismissed. It isn't urgent enough. If you're sending out that message on the same channel that you're watching, you're on the same platforms that you were like watching, you know, schlocky TV that you should watch because you're trying to recover from your bad week, or from on the same platforms where you're seeing your friends' vacation photos, or on the same platform where you're excited to hear about us talk about Red Dead Redemption, like, it's so easy to file that information away. But when you leave those platforms and those methods of discourse behind and take more radical action, the second you do that, and even not that radical action, I don't think stopping someone in an elevator and shouting about your experience of being a target of sexual assault is that radical a thing.
But there were people, even there, people yelling at Susan Collins. I know. People were like, you should never yell at a senator.
Never yell at a senator. Oh, people on the left were saying that, Rob. People we know were saying that. As if being a senator somehow carries with it a shield for all public criticism. That is immediately dismissed on the grounds of it not being going through one of these platforms that have lost all of their efficacy. And so, I don't know. For me, it's like the answer is pretty simple. You just have to tune out those people and actually say the thing. It is that important. It is that important in the face of the news that 10 to 20 to 30 years from now, there will be no going back, that we have to start moving immediately on these issues in the face of articles like the one about Zuckerberg, who is making decisions about a platform that affects millions and millions of people on a whim. Like
billions.
Billions of people now. You're right. On a whim. You have to be willing to find new vectors so that you can be heard. And for me, the first and biggest way of doing that is organizing in number. Facebook is bigger than a march, right? It is billions of people. But there is still something very powerful about 10,000 people walking down a street. That's not that many people, but it's a lot of people.
10,000 people walking down
a
street,
you
have
the
shit to be there. Like, a billion people on Facebook are there for whatever the fuck reason. But like 10,000 people, like, that's different. That's like, you're here.
Yeah.
Like, you've chosen to
be. There's a potential energy to it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we still think of our physical bodies and physical space as being more real than things that happen on the internet. I do think we are still attuned to that as a species.
Well, I think also, like, just we aggressively train ourselves and other people to tune out things on the internet for your own sanity. But like there is,
yeah.
It is difficult to know what is real on the internet at times. It is difficult to know how much energy and like genuine concern and sincerity is like is real on the internet at times.
Yeah.
There is something different about like physical presence and commitment. But yeah, anyway, so that's what I've been working over this week, is just thinking about like, what do you do with somebody who just refuses to listen or do the right thing and wants to subvert every system you're supposed to have access to for redress of grievances. Anyway, that'll do it for this week's Waypoints. Our thanks to Too Mellow for the track Slide Asleep off the album After Midnight. You can find that at twomellowmakes.bandcamp.com, and you can keep up with all of us at waypoint.vice.com. I'm Rob Zachney, and you can find me on Twitter at Rob Zachney. Patrick, where can people keep up with you online?
You can find me at Patrick Klubik. And I want to make an aside that if you liked the New York article about Mark Zuckerberg, it was also a fantastic companion interview with Terry Gross on Fresh Air, in which Evan Osnos has a discussion about the piece with some extra details. So nice. Just an FYI.
Danielle.
You can find me at Danielle R.I.
Austin.
At Austin_Walker. And on that same tip, there was also an incredible and detailed motherboard piece on this problem that gets into the problem of moderation at Facebook, called The Impossible Job Inside Facebook's Struggle to Moderate 2 Billion People. That is also worth a read. It is not as much on the Zuckerberg side, but it is very much on the like, what is it you do? How do you do that thing that is fascinating and scary?
All right. Well, we hope you've enjoyed the break, as grim as it could sometimes be. I wish we had better, clearer answers for you if you came here looking for those, but hopefully at least you left with some decent food for thought, or a decent podcast backlog or reading list. We'll be back soon with... Is this week Red Dead?
This week is Red Dead.
Yeah, so we're going to be coming at you again real soon with a Waypoint 101 on Red Dead Redemption, a game that, if you know me, I adore. I just celebrate every moment, every beat of Red Dead Redemption. I think it's a fantastic addition to the canon of great American Westerns. And I hope you'll listen to that, especially if you really love Red Dead and want to hear somebody sing its praises. Be sure and tune in.
You're cruel.
Anyway, hope you'll join us for that. Until then, do not give in to estrangement. Spare neither.